You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, the world's eyes remain fixed on Europe's migration crisis as Italian authorities make two arrests.
We carried out two arrest warrants of suspected traffickers. We're talking about the captain of the ship and a member of the crew.
Italian prosecutor Rocco Liguori there. But in the absence of worldwide cooperation, can anything put a stop to the desperate flow of displaced people? I'll discuss that with my guests James Schneider and Daniela Peled. Also ahead, South African President Jacob Zuma deploys the country's military in an effort to curb mounting violence against foreigners.
To our brothers and sisters from the continent, we have said before that when we were in trouble, they helped us to fight our own liberation. They did not chase us away. And therefore it is important for us to bear that in mind.
We'll examine whether xenophobia is really at the core of the country's unrest. Plus, Egypt's former president gets 20 years in prison. And when high flyers fall from grace, is it ever okay to use one's wrongdoing for personal gain? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are James Schneider, the editorial director at New Africa magazine, and from the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, Daniela Peled. Welcome both to the show. Now, after yesterday's emergency EU meeting in Luxembourg, questions remain over how Europe might respond to the increasingly desperate boatloads of migrants willing to risk everything for a chance at reaching European shores. Some suggest that Europe might adopt an isolationist policy similar to the harsh treatment given to asylum seekers by the Australian government. Others, however, such as the Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, say that the EU and the wider world must focus on improving conditions in conflict-torn areas. I think we can guess that this is not a simple problem. Daniel, when you look at the issue, you know, do we try and stop people getting on the boats in the first place, or do we become more proficient at dealing with people when they land on European shores?
Well, it's really not an either-or situation. I mean, the Australian paradigm, quite apart from its moral implications, I don't think would work in Europe. Australia is an island, albeit a gigantic one. It's quite difficult to get to it. In Europe, there are all kinds of different routes, and the distances are much smaller, and the crises are much nearer. Now, the only way this can be tackled is by a variety of means. In the long term, international development is key. If you have enormous disparity between different countries, inevitably people will want to move from one space to another.
But that's such a long-term thing, you know, to equal out, you know, the wealth of Africa and the wealth of Europe, or the security of Africa.
I mean, it's not even about Africa and Europe. Within Europe, you'll find people moving from poorer countries to to wealthier countries, and within Africa as well. I mean, that's part of the human condition. The idea is to actually create some opportunities. You hear the stories of some migrants who are saying, well, you know, at least this way I have a chance of economic or literal survival. So, I mean, that's also a long-term issue. The fact is, for instance, I mean, most of the migrants, I think 90% of the migrants coming through Italy at the moment are coming from Libya. And there's just no way of coordinating with Libya or the Libyan authorities, such as they are at the moment, to try and stop ships leaving, for instance. It's an enormous, enormous industry. And then the question is, what do you do with the migrants when they reach Europe, whether they're economic migrants or refugees? And the fact is that it's exceptionally difficult for anybody to have a reasonable published discussion on this. I mean, right now we're in election season here, and all the parties have been grabbing on this idea of migration. We're not even talking about refugees here. We're talking about even movement within the European Union. It's such a touchy subject. I think you need a politician and a political grouping to be really brave to actually say we have to discuss this seriously and logically and rationally.
James, you know, the rights argument on this would be that if you make it so simple for people to be picked up at sea and, you know, brought to Italy, brought to Malta, then they will keep on coming. And unless you kind of do something harsh, i.e. returning people or kind of making, you know, the internment that they face so grim that they it puts people off, it will just continue. Do you think there's any fairness or rightness in that argument? Because on the other side, the idea that, well, we should just pick them all up just does mean that more and more people seem to be coming.
No, it's a completely nonsense argument. One, it doesn't work at all. More people have tried to cross the Mediterranean this year after they stopped as many patrols as they did before than they did last year of the same period of time. By some estimates 30-fold and by other estimates 50-fold. So clearly the policy of, well, we're going to drown you so that you don't come, or it's a disincentive to your cousin to come, doesn't even work as a policy, let alone the, as Daniela kind of politely put it, the moral implications, you know, the real sort of moral dustbin of that. And I think it's important that we do keep these sort of longer term things that need to be done in mind, as Daniela was saying, because that does keep at the centre ideas of sort of long-term justice, which is what this is about. But in the short term, I think we need to do, as Daniela says, a variety of things, both in the countries that are sending the migrants and in the sea, and then also domestically. So there needs to be far more boats. That needs to be coordinated at EU level. There needs to be way more spending on it, and there needs to be stopping as many people from dying as possible. Then European-wide, we need to take many more refugees and asylum seekers from the world's conflicts. At the moment, we are taking a pitifully small number of people from Syria, for example, and expecting Jordan and Lebanon, two significantly more fragile and poorer countries than any country in Europe, to bear this enormous burden of millions and millions of refugees. We should be putting a huge pressure on our supposed ally in Egypt, Abdel Fattah Sisi, to stop antagonizing the civil war in Libya, to try to push his ally, Khalifa Haftar, to the negotiating table so that at least something can begin to be done with Libya. And we need to set up a US-style work permit lottery system in distressed countries so that there is a means through which people can basically run the lottery game, which they're doing with their lives by crossing the ocean, in a way which is less dangerous.
All very well and good, but as Daniela said, if you go to Libya, there is no kind of, you know, we don't even recognise the functioning government in Tripoli. We recognise the supposedly the real government sitting in Benghazi. There is no way that you can offer any kind of visas on the ground there. You can't. There's nobody to coordinate
with.
No,
I'm saying there isn't in Libya right now, which is why additional efforts have to be stepped up, and we have to stop being partisan, actually, as we are within that civil conflict. But there are other staging grounds. Like, how do people get to Libya in the first place? They tend to get there via Khartoum in Sudan or Agadez in Niger. Those are places which are reasonably stable. One of them, Europe has good relations with. The other one, Europe has bad relations with. So try to work as best as you can with Niger in this case. Yes, there are huge numbers of difficulties in dealing with this issue, but it seems like politicians in Europe seem to be overwhelmingly saying, well, it's very difficult, so we're not going to really do anything, or we're going to talk about the bit which is palatable, which is cracking down on human traffickers, who are, of course, part of the problem, but they're not in any way the sole or the primary part of the problem.
Daniel, in this super complicated issue, you know, today they've just arrested the Tunisian captain of the ship that sank, with 900 people now believed to be dead. So let's just take a step back. I'm the captain of that boat. I now know that Europe feels something must be done to pick migrants up at sea. And we've already seen this happening, that captains are phoning the Coast Guard saying, we're on our way, the ship will be at this point at this time, come collect us. Does it mean that that's suddenly sanctioned in a way that you're making it almost, you know, an official ferry route, that anybody who's setting off from the coast of Tunisia, Libya, you're guaranteeing that the people will be picked up, they'll be put into a refugee camp, and yes, in a year's time, you will have a visa. How do you stop the trade?
Well, in the absence of any other route to get into Europe, that's what people do. I mean, I agree. I think if there's a way. A way of visas, work permits, even expensive ones, that gives people another route. I mean, I disagree with James, because I think what has happened in Australia has worked. Zero people have been allowed in. And what's happened in Israel, for instance, they built an enormous fence. Zero migrants came in. But then again, you lose all moral authority when you get to that. And I just don't think that that would work in Europe. I don't think we'll accept that. And I think the response to this latest disaster has been interesting. I think there has been a lot of public sympathy. There probably more public sympathy had it been, you know, a commuter ferry in somewhere within Europe, perhaps. But I think it does provide an opportunity for this conversation to begin. Now, dealing with the traffickers, I think that's possibly the most palatable way for politicians to find a way into this, to sell it to the public, saying we are going to target the traffickers, we're going to target the industry, just the same way that they can sell the war on drugs as a war against, you know, big cartels. And,
and the war on drugs doesn't work, and the war on traffickers won't work either.
I agree with you, Jay. I just want to jump in here. James, do you think we're in just one of these kind of liberal dinner party messes kind of turned out into kind of global policy? Because if we'd left Gaddafi where he was, if we'd left, you know, Assad alone, then all of those countries, the people wouldn't have left. Thousands more people would be alive today than they were 3 years ago. Yes, we've done our bit to kind of say that we don't like dictatorships. But the fact is that, you know, before Gaddafi fell, he had an agreement with the Italians. If people were seen in boats, he would pick them up, he'd bring them back. You know, he would deal with them there in Libya, and the trade wasn't seen as a profitable one. Now we've kind of gone half-hearted in kind of, yes, we've toppled Gaddafi, but we haven't put in place all you need for a successful regime. You know, we have, you know, done our bit to make sure that Syria is unstable, but we have no end game in sight. Do you think you can't really have one without the other? Either you have to do something on the ground in Libya, you have to do something on the ground in Assad, Syria, or you have to just take all these people and say, well, this is our doing.
Well, I mean, I think we do bear a reasonably large responsibility with Libya. I mean, let's not pretend that the previous situation either was either good for the Libyan people or good for migrants. I mean, part of the reason why migrants are coming from Libya is because migrants used to come to Libya because Libya used to be a reasonably prosperous country where there were places to work, and now that has been closed down. And yes, I think very clearly it is unacceptable for politicians who were involved and cheerleaded and gained political capital out of the overthrow of Gaddafi to then basically turn around and not be involved with its consequences as they start affecting millions of people.
Well, we're going to move on. There's so many more elements to this story, which I'm sure we will come back to over the coming days. But just when it seemed as though South Africa's spate of violence against foreigners might be subsiding, the country's government deployed the military in an effort to contain the situation. Many of the nation's poorest areas have been plagued in recent days by continued violence against people from outside South Africa who are blamed for taking the country's jobs. And we should point out, these are people who have come from neighbouring countries. James, we'll start off with you again. Is this xenophobia, or is this actually just the failure of the South African government to provide the jobs and homes that people expected? Even now, after all these years after apartheid, there just doesn't feel to be the change that people expected. And there is just deep-rooted anger about that.
There is deep-rooted anger about the failures of overcoming sufficiently quickly the problems and of apartheid. But that is what, or one of the factors that drives xenophobia. I don't think that we should sort of view xenophobia as a sort of mental condition which is totally separated from any sort of material realities. They work together. And one of the drivers, one of the large drivers of xenophobia has been failures in service delivery, lack of jobs, lack of fundamental transformation of South African society for a large number of people. But there are other factors as well within the politics. I mean, there are elements of totally sanctioned politics which speak towards nationalism of various sorts, ethnic nationalism, which can stir up. You could see how the Zulu King didn't get slapped down fast enough when, you know, his comments were some of those that incited the bout of violence in Durban, which is in KwaZulu-Natal. So I don't think there's a kind of disjunct between the two. They very much work together.
Daniel James is referencing the King there, the Zulu King here, who certainly stirred, it seems, some of this issue up. Very slow to apologise. It said we need to have some discussions. But also Jacob Zuma you know, just doesn't seem to be a man who can lead the whole country. You forget it's very factional, South Africa.
This is it. You need it. I mean, it is also a failure of leadership, a failure of law enforcement. If you have a culture of impunity, then violence like this will continue. And also, it seems a failure to accept that this is racist, xenophobic violence, that South Africans are targeting immigrants without any justification. So that needs to be acted upon. And I agree completely with James. This is the situation like you would find in any country in this situation. I mean, South Africa has got, I think, the second largest income gap in the world. And if you're confronted with a situation like that, then, you know, the incomers are going to be the ones in the line of fire.
James.
So, I think part of the lack of narrative is part of the problem. During apartheid, there was, an understanding that the reason why your situation is very, very difficult is because there is this, structurally racist regime which is making your lives miserable. Then there was the Rainbow Nation narrative, which brought people together sufficiently, and then that sort of fractured under the realities of the failure of sufficient socioeconomic transformation. And because the elite is somewhat obscured, those who are causing or who are insufficiently rectifying the problems of ordinary South Africans, there is a lot of kicking down rather than kicking up. And because there isn't a narrative which argues, or enough of a narrative which correctly locates people's problems, they will then place it with the outsider, with the other, as we see in many, many countries across the world.
And James, we should just tie this back into the story we started with, you know, because this is kind of South-South migration. This is, you know, people from the likes of Mozambique, from Zambia, from other countries in Southern Africa, looking south and seeing South Africa as a wealthy place to head to. How big is that kind of migration story in Africa?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really important point, that it's difficult to say because no one knows how many Zimbabweans are, but there are some million, let's say, but somewhere between 2 and 5 million foreigners in South Africa in a population of 50 million. And that's because, yes, South Africa is regionally, it's got much better infrastructure. You've got better chances. People want to go there. But for the poorer South Africans, for the majority of South Africans, then don't feel like they live in a rich country with lots of opportunities. So it feels like when people come in, they're taking from a very small pie. Now, of course, that in no way at all justifies the incredible levels of xenophobia. But back to your question. Yeah, there's plenty of migration across the continent. There's some very cosmopolitan places. A lot of Johannesburg is a very cosmopolitan place.
And it's strange that we, again, before we move on, an echo, I guess, of, you know, that failure of political leadership, you know, what we're seeing from the West in the Middle East, but also maybe Jacob Zuma, if he had been a stronger voice in some of the issues that were happening in Zimbabwe, for example, then it would be a different narrative that was unfolding out. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Daniela Peled and James Schneider. Coming up, Egypt's former president has been sentenced to 20 years in prison. Is it a purely political driven move? We'll discuss that next.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back. This is Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, here on Monocle 24. And still with me is Daniela Peled and James Schneider. Now, Egypt's former president, Mohamed Morsi, is joining 12 other defendants in prison today after being sentenced to 20 years in what is largely seen as a politically fueled verdict. The ruling comes after Morsi was found to have incited the killing of 10 protesters outside the presidential palace in 2012. However, with Egypt's political climate growing increasingly dangerous, dangerous. Many are seeing the court's decision as yet another warning against any opposition voices. Daniela, you know, in many ways, as we were talking about during the break there, at least he hasn't been put to death, which is quite a common result of court cases these days in Egypt. I think some 1,400 people are currently awaiting to be supposedly killed or on death, the Egypt's equivalent of death row. What did you make of the judgment?
Yeah, I mean, we have reached a pretty pickle where this is seen as leniency and clemency. I mean, Morsi isn't a young man. 20 years in prison is, in effect, a life sentence for him. And as I understand, there are still charges for which he could be sentenced to death. Perhaps it was seen that a death sentence would have just been pushing the Muslim Brotherhood too far. Although there hasn't been, you know, massive protests in Egypt at this result, you know, it's a sign of how far their power has dwindled. I mean, it's interesting to contrast it with the outcome of Hosni Mubarak's trial. He was initially sentenced to life in prison, no more. The only thing that was left on his charge sheet was 3 years for embezzlement, and even that was overturned. I think it's currently under review. So I don't think we need to have any illusions about the Egyptian justice system when it comes to how it treats former presidents.
James, you know, the verdict is obviously political in many ways. And again, do you think there'll be no protest from the West? You know, this is an extinguishing of democracy in many ways. Do you think it will just go quietly unnoticed?
Sadly, yes. I mean, the response from Western leaders, particularly John Kerry and Catherine Ashton, to Sisi's coup and subsequent crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood was, how do we say this, really shameful. I mean, providing cover for Sisi's crackdown, undermining of rights, undermining of democratic space, undermining of independent journalism, and undermining of freedom of association. I mean, all sorts of things were given cover. And yes, no, I mean, Mohamed Morsi was in no ways a perfect leader. There are many things that were wrong with his short rule in Egypt, but he deserves, and the prospect or the possibility of greater democracy and rights in Egypt deserves a far tougher response than will sadly happen.
Daniela, we can reference this back again to this, the story we're talking about, what's happening in North Africa with migration and things. Well, when you look at the region, do you feel that, again, it's one of these issues where, you know, we would like to see democratic institutions, you know, one man, one vote, a kind of a nice version of kind of Western democracy there. But in the end, you know, is it still a region of, you know, strong man and even strong women politics? You know, that it is a place where to succeed, you need somebody who can unite. You know, we look at Libya. It's not a natural country in many ways. It's divisive, it's tribal, it's kind of fallen into factions. That in some ways you do need somebody to lead the country, and that's why the West turns a blind eye to all these things, because they feel at least it's not fallen into what Libya was, or it's not falling apart like Syria is. Let's put up with a little bit, you know, of this kind of tough man politics, because he's holding the country together.
I don't believe in any way that this is a foregone conclusion in really any of these states, because places are tribal or unnatural countries. I mean, what I've seen in many parts of the Middle East, in these supposed unnatural countries, people's desire for democracy is very, very strong. And not just democracy going beyond the ability to vote, but also respect for human rights and all the other things that make democracy real. But I think what's very clear is that we in the West have come to the conclusion that a stable dictatorship is much better than a chaotic attempt at a democracy, and we'll take that every time. And that is what has happened in Egypt. The West and Washington were very slow to come around to the idea of Mubarak being toppled, and there were no tears shed when the Sisi coup, although, you know, wasn't even termed a coup. But yeah, no, this is good news for the West. They want someone that they can cooperate with on security, on migration. And if there was a coup if there was something similar in Libya or anywhere else in the region, there would be many people in policy-making circles who would be delighted, sad to say.
Now, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but we want to fit in briefly one final story, which is about New York's former police commissioner who used to be on top of the world. During the reign of Mayor Rudy Giuliani, Bernie Kerik was really known as the city's top cop, a tough career policeman who was once eyeing off a plum role in George W. Bush's White House. Then he found himself in court battling accusations of tax fraud. Now he's been released from jail and he's written a book about his changed life, and he's on a tour to drum up business. James, do you think it's fair enough? You've done your time. You can make some more money from these things?
I mean, there are meant to be laws to stop people making money from immoral actions, but if people didn't make money from immoral actions, the implications are perhaps somewhat broader. I've heard that this book is very boring, and it might be somewhat like Conrad Black's book when he comes out. It has some really, really good interviews on the news. It looks very exciting. He picks a fight with Jeremy Paxman, and then three people read it.
Daniel, I saw even this week that the family of Goebbels were trying to make some royalties from, because his diaries are being published by Random House. Is there no end to kind of people's shame? Do you think this is fair enough for him to kind of cash in?
Well, do you know, I think it's fair enough as long as it's entertaining. If it's entertaining, you can get away with whatever you want. In Britain, we had the venerable Geoffrey Archer, who went to prison and managed to get three volumes of prison diaries out. Now, I haven't read them, but I imagine they're in sync with the rest of his oeuvre. So yeah, if it's a rollicking good read, you know, why not? Morals be damned.
Well, I think that Mr. Archer's books were at least meant to be a rollicking good read, but yes, we're not quite sure about all of the morality. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. James Schneider and Daniela Pellad, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. And that's all we have time for on today's show. The show was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also Mike Hune. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, well, Daniel Giacopelli is going to be here keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist. Then at 1900 hours, it's Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, who's going to be here with Section D. At 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily. And then Midori House, well, it's going to be back at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 hours London time. And also look out for a special urbanist this week, where we're going to be catching up with some of the events that took place in Lisbon this weekend, where we held the inaugural Monocle Quality of Life Conference. But for now, from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening.